Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
All right, let's do this. How are you? What the fuckers? What the fuck? What happened? What the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fucking ears? What the fuckabilities? Wow, that just dropped out on me in the middle. How's it going? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast, WTF. It's called WTF. Welcome to it. If you're not familiar with it, if you're just here for the first time to listen to me and the amazing Jenji Kohan, talk about her life, her career, her creativity. You know, some of these glow interviews are not, these are not promotional interviews. This is a choice that, you know, I made with my producer, Brendan, to, you know, talk to the people that I worked with on Glow. But we've got some good ones coming up. But this is a full career interview with Jenji, and I've got the writers coming up to sort of talk about that process. I've got the showrunners, the creators coming up to talk about that process. And I got Chavo Guerrero, the wrestler, and Kia Stevens coming up to talk about the real wrestling angle of the show Glow. It's all happening in the future, among other people. It's not all going to be about Glow. We're gonna pace it out. We're gonna spread them out like professionals. So, thank you for all of the amazing feedback for the show Glow, the gorgeous ladies of wrestling. I appreciate all the love for my acting, for my character, and for the show as a whole. I couldn't have. You know, I was made better by the people surrounding me and the people around, certainly on the show. And I just watched it. I watched the first five, but I had not watched the second five, which is where my character, Sam Sylvia, sort of kind of gets a little deeper, gets a little more stuff going on, get a little more inner stuff. And it was wild. It's wild to watch yourself on television as somebody else. And I know some of you folks are like, Maron just playing himself, but am I really? I mean, you guys know me. I mean, I was never that much of an asshole. Look, I was an asshole, but I was not that particular kind of an asshole. I had a little of that in me, obviously, but I was not essentially, you know, that abusive in that way. It seems it's a little muted on the show because the guy's sort of a loser. But look, I'm going to bring myself to every role I'm in because that's all I got. I got some chops. I got some experience, but, you know, I'm no wizard. I'm no method man, method actor. I'm no, I can do stuff that's within my wheelhouse. And he certainly was. But again, thrilled that all of you like it. And watching it, you know, the second half and watching the whole series, which I binged, the emotional component of this show and the sort of, you know, the drive of the entire show moving towards this team of wrestlers, dealing with the obstacles personally and professionally and as a team and as a group was very compelling to me. I got choked up watching all the scenes. I get hurt watching me as a guy, you know, yell at Allison or just being the way I am. Like I watch it and I'm tearing up. That's how much distance I have from it, even though I was in it. I just find it to be a very entertaining and heartfelt show, and I'm happy to be part of it, and I'm happy that you like it, and I'm excited to talk to Jenji Kohan today about all her shows and about where she came from. So that's happening. I'm doing what I said I would do. I'm taking some, it's kind of downtime. I'm just, you know, through the tunnel of it all. And I might actually have a summer here, but I do have to get on the cardio. The cardio has to happen. Apparently I just got my blood tests back and, my cholesterol is under control thanks to medicine, but now everything else is normal and healthy except for this one test. I don't know what it was, but it implies The nerve of science, the nerve of medical testing to imply that I may eat too much sugar and carbs and I'm at risk for maybe diabetes. The nerve of science. And so I don't even know what that is. I don't eat candy. I don't eat ice cream. I think it's like I do consume probably 2 to 3 pineapples a week and slathering Wasa crackers with almond butter and honey might have a bit to do with it. You think? Maybe that's it. Brown rice is a carb. Whatever the case, I'm just happy that I have health coverage. I'm happy that my union has not been destroyed and that it functions and that they take my money when they take it. And if I make enough money in either the actor union or the writer union, that, you know, I get wonderful health coverage and I can go in, you know, that day to the clinic and see what's up. And most people can't do that. For years, I didn't have coverage. I was in and out of plans. I was on Cobra or I was just winging it. You know, I've been freaked out and I've gotten onto Kaiser when necessary. I know what it feels like not to have health coverage. And after a certain age, if you're certain, depending what your life is, it's terrifying. We're all going to get sick. We're all going to die. You would hope that we could live in a country where we could do everything we could to not die. If it is a medical problem, and everything we could to sort of die comfortably with the right care. You would think that would be a part of it. But I guess what I'm getting at is what they're doing to healthcare in this country is horrible and it's frightening and it's going to kill a lot of people. It may be 10 years down the line or however far down the line they want to push it. I know there are those people, look, if you can afford it, good for you. Life's working out for you. But if you can't, or if you're old or you're poor or you have pre-existing conditions, I guess the idea is like, well, you know, good luck. You know, the way capitalism works is that, you know, we can't afford to have the government involved with healthcare because capitalism needs a turnover. If you're only taking and you're not giving back, at some point, we got to let you go. Cynical. It's cynical. Call your senators and express how you feel. Because they are elected representatives. Capitalism does have some flaws, completely relying on the free market as a belief system. For some reason, it doesn't really take into consideration as a belief system, as a dogma, that there's nothing there to regulate. There's no seven deadly sins. And even if there is, if they're not all consuming, it's okay. It's okay in the system. For some reason, they never really take into mind just the malignancy of greed. But, you know, believers are believers. But do call your representatives if you feel strongly or you're sick and, you know, you're going to die or you care about people who are sick or are going to die and now it's just going to be a decade-long free fall for them. If you care about those people, give your senators a call. Do it. I've been down the Vietnam rabbit hole. I got a screener of Ken Burns' new documentary. It's a 10-part documentary on the Vietnam War that's coming out, I believe, in September. I'm preparing to have a conversation with Mr. Burns. But, man, did I not know. You know, that is not my generation. You know, I knew it was bad news. And I knew that, you know, it changed everything. Everything culturally. And I did not know the history and it's just mind blowing that some of the same fights that we were fighting culturally then that started then are just continuing now. Where does it all come from? Greed and ego. And the Powell memo. That's all I'm going to say. Yeah, you can Google that. That's all I'm going to say. Not going to get too deep into it. But do, you know, take action. Tough times we live in for a lot of people. So Jenji Kohan, she's a bona fide showbiz genius in a lot of ways. She's created a lot of great shows. Weeds, Orange is the New Black. She's been in the game for a long time. She sort of comes from show business. I was excited to talk to her because she doesn't talk a lot in these things, or to people from what I know. And I worked for her. So, and I wanted to get the true story as to how I was cast in GLOW. So I'm asking everybody who knows. So I'll bring it right to the top. So this is me and the producer, Genji.
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
Bohan. You don't do this much, huh?
I do not.
I think I met you at a thing.
What thing?
The round table where I was outgunned and out of place.
Oh, God.
I just remember, like, why am I here? I have not done anything.
But you did. You made a show. That's
I know, but I'm
do.
Not. I didn't do it at the level that you guys did, you know?
What's the level? You still have to write them, produce them, post them, everything.
Right.
It's still all the work.
Right, but if you were to ask me about post-production, I'd be like, oh, those other guys did it.
Oh,
like,
really?
I did editing and I was there, but it's scheduling and all that, I didn't do that. I didn't.
Neither do we.
You know?
We don't schedule it. We have line producers.
Right, line producers.
And post-producers.
I was there with the writing, the acting, and the stories and, you know, and the casting and everything else, but the nuts and bolts of it, like how it works.
But the nuts and bolts is you hire people who are really good at their job and say, yeah, go do that.
When did you learn that?
Pretty early on. I got lucky. That's the whole trick.
You can't control it?
As a sort of control freak.
Yeah.
I try to control it, but as a human being, I've had to learn to relinquish.
So let's start with a couple of pressing questions. And I don't usually do this, but what happened with the hostage taking of the Orange is the New Black season? Was that a real thing?
Yeah. The Dark Overlord took the show hostage, and we were advised not to pay ransom because someone else had, and they still released them.
Right.
So they're untrustworthy thieves. Oh. And
they don't even
there's no honor among those thieves.
No honor. Yeah, wow.
But the fortunate thing was they only got the first 10 out of 13.
Yeah.
So now it's like a cliffhanger for anyone who watched the bootleg.
Really? How many people really do that, though?
Hopefully not a lot. And there was, surprisingly, the fans were amazing. They backed the corporation over the Dark Overlord. They're like, don't do this to the show. Don't watch. So.
And it's not easy. Usually it's not that easy to find where that stuff is posted. Like,
no.
You got to have a certain, you know, know-how. But was there anything, did Netflix say, like, you know, it's not going to hurt us?
No, they said, they describe it as a situation and that they're dealing with it. But
yeah. What season is this?
They kidnapped season 5 and now we're writing season 6. But again, there are still 3 that weren't pirated. So.
Right. And I guarantee you very few people watched it.
I choose to believe that.
Yeah, I just don't like I don't think that people are that proficient in finding things. It's not like they put it up on an alternate Netflix.
Right.
It was probably buried somewhere.
I think somewhere like Pirate Bay. I don't
know. Yeah, yeah.
I'm like giving people the place. But I think people are afraid to illegally download because there's so many bugs and viruses and things like that. So.
Yeah, and you don't know what list you'll be on or you know. So the other question is, let's start with me. How did I get cast in GLOW?
Because you were perfect for the part. You completely inhabit that man. There is no competition at all.
Uh huh.
And you were amazing and are amazing.
Thank you. Well, how do you conceive of things? Because you're obviously, you know, the ensemble cast that you put together with you and whoever you've delegated
out.
Right, Jen Houston. But I mean, it's massive. You know, with Orange is the New Black and even this show, I mean, there's like 14 girls, women.
Right.
And like, it's so important to balance that out. And I guess I was just curious in terms of GLOW. Because I talked to Carly and Liz, and mm-hmm. and I know you were all part of it, and that I don't know who else you looked at, but what was the element in terms of maleness that had to be at the center of that thing?
I mean, honestly, you just took it because you did. Because you're that perfect combination of smart and jaded,
yeah.
you know, hard edge with a soft center.
yeah.
You know that era to a certain extent, and it's just one of those serendipitous things when you find the perfect person for the part. You just say yes. You stop looking. You don't. You know, it's enough. It's
and that
lucky.
Happens.
Yeah, it does on occasion.
All right. So we'll come back to Glow. I want to talk about show business.
Okay.
And I'm gonna drink more coffee.
All right. I'm having the most LA drink ever.
What is it?
I'm having a hemp milk dirty chai latte.
Oh my God.
Well, I usually have regular milk, but I was told it's bad for your voice, and this is my big radio debut. So
is it? Yeah, I don't know about that hemp milk. It has a some sort of weird gaminess to it.
There's a little sourness,
right.
I would say.
Yeah, yeah. I don't think it was ever meant for milk. I think it's a stretch.
Right, I think so.
Yeah.
It's my first one.
You like I talked to you briefly on the set, and then I became sort of fascinated with the idea that you were brought up in show business.
But
as an industry, I mean, you know, right?
It was a very there was a division of labor in my household. And my dad was in the business, and he did his thing over here.
Yeah.
And my mother was in the domestic sphere, and she did her stuff over here. And although she was a writer too. And my father's work was always really separate. He'd go off.
You grew up in Beverly Hills, though.
It's like the last house. Across the street was L.A. It was so we could go to the schools. But right. Yes, officially, yes.
But not like a man. You're not living next to Carl Reiner or anybody.
No.
Not in the big houses.
Not in the big houses. My mother describes it as Hawaiian modern.
That's what it was?
It had big, like,
did it have a tiki
rocks.
Bar in it?
No tiki bar, but they did turn the garage into a music room with carpet on the ceiling and in the corners yeah. for my brother's band, Midnight Fantasy.
How did Midnight Fantasy pan out? How did that go?
They made it all the way through high school. It was really impressive. Although now they claim the name is Mount Funk because Midnight Fantasy isn't as cool, but it was Midnight
Fantasy. It was Midnight Fantasy. Yeah. Everyone makes that bad mistake with mm-hmm. the first band name. So what part of show business was he in?
My father was the king of variety television.
The king. That's what they called him?
The king? I mean, he really, I don't know, he's more biblical than regal.
Yeah.
But he did every special, award show, variety show, nightclub acts. He has, I think, 13 or 14 Emmys. He was the guy. He was the go-to guy.
He produced them.
No, he wrote them.
He wrote them.
Yeah.
So he's a big joke writer.
Joke, but patter and music, and he knew how to put on a show.
Yeah.
And,
where did he learn that?
Well, he was a composition major at Eastman.
Yeah. Where's that?
In Rochester.
Uh-huh.
And he came out of school, and he was in the entertainment corps.
Uh-huh.
And he traveled around the world entertaining the troops.
But putting together shows, like
yeah,
variety shows?
Yeah, putting together shows, variety shows.
So that's where he learned it.
Like probably. Well, then he went back to New York, and he was doing like the Hi Mom show and writing Felix the Cat and Beetle Bailey cartoons and
really?
Things like that. And then he was offered 30 weeks of steady work in California, and that was the longest stretch he'd ever been offered. So my whole family moved to L.A.
Yeah.
And that was the Carol Burnett show. So he started on the Carol Burnett show
in
L.A.
A writer.
As a writer.
Really?
Yeah.
And how old were you?
I wasn't born yet. I was born in L.A.
The Carol Burnett show?
Yeah.
That's like a massive comedy show.
Yeah.
And he was like I don't even know how many writers those kind of things. Now you like some places have a dozen writers. I can't
right.
even.
I don't know how many.
It's probably like three or four.
But he
guys.
Also did music. You know the thing that comes out every Christmas with Bing Crosby and David Bowie?
Yeah, yeah.
My dad wrote the counter melody. The Peace on Earth, can it?
Oh, really?
Because that was from one of his Christmas specials.
Peace on Earth.
Yeah, yeah.
And they were both going at the same time.
Yeah, yeah. Because I guess David Bowie came to him and said, I don't want to sing, drummer boy, and blah, blah, blah. So they quickly ran downstairs and wrote this counter melody, and that became...
And what show was that for? Your dad?
It was like Bing Crosby Christmas
special. And it's one of those things your dad wrote for?
Yeah.
And he was just there?
Yeah.
Now, like, does that mean, like, I'm always trying to force this this idea that at that time in Los Angeles and show business, it was a much more intimate business and people hung around with each other and everybody knew each other. Like, did you have people? Well, he was a writer, though. It wasn't like you had people at the house.
Well,
or-
well my one access to sort of Hollywood at large mm-hmm. was there used to be the Carl Reiner family picnic every year in mm-hmm. Rancho Park. And it was this crazy potluck picnic
yeah.
where everyone happened to be in the business with yeah. their kids doing potato sack races.
Right.
But like Mel Brooks would judge the makeup contest.
Yeah.
And, oh God, who would lead science?
He's so funny, right?
I think he's got a good sense of humor. and it was just like sort of this weirdly star-studded thing,
yeah.
but it was like this annual, not like, it was this annual family.
It's a neighborhood thing?
That we'd go to. A neighborhood being Hollywood, I guess.
Yeah, yeah.
But beyond that, I mean, we had access to people if, like, we needed to talk to someone from a school for a school project.
Oh, yeah? Did you do that?
Well, I got into a fight with a teacher once over interpreting Michael Jackson lyrics, and I got a signed affidavit from Michael saying that it's open to interpretation.
You did?
I had to be switched out of that class. We were not getting along.
What was that about?
It was just, she was saying this is what he means in this song. I don't
what
know.
Song
she was trying
was
to be
it?
Cool. I honestly
you don't
can't remember.
Remember.
But, and I was saying that's not necessarily, you know, I was just.
Sure. Pushing the envelope.
Always.
Yeah.
Always. I was not an easy kid. So.
Did you make teachers cry?
I don't know if I made them cry. I certainly made them angry.
Yeah. Right. I did that too.
Depending on the teacher.
By confronting them, by being funny or by challenging them, usually?
Mostly challenging. I was very frustrated by being a child. And I felt everyone was patronizing me. It's like, don't talk down to me. And, you know, it made me angry.
So you went above her head and you contacted Michael Jackson's
people? I did.
People. You had your
My
dad
used to
out?
Write the tours for the Jackson 5. And later he wrote Motown 25 and all that stuff. And, you know, he was in touch with them.
Throughout?
And, yeah. So I was like, can you do this?
What did your teacher say? She goes,
that was when I got switched out of the class. Because it was just like
you used your connections.
I did.
That's hilarious.
I did.
But other than, you know, having certain connections, you weren't and going to the picnic.
It was well. There was one. My mom had two poker games every week.
So that's post Mahjong, I guess. Jews playing Mahjong.
I play Mahjong now.
You do?
Yes, I do.
Where did that come from?
It's sweeping the nation.
Is it really?
Oh my God, yes. I have two games that I go to every week.
Mahjong.
If I can make it. Yeah, Mahjong. And it's so pleasing. The sound and the clacking.
I used to hear it. My grandmother played with a bunch of ladies in New Jersey. Like there would be all three. One night my grandfather would play poker and the other night the women, like literally the wives of the poker players would play Mahjong.
Well, sometimes when I'm playing poker, one woman's house, her husband's in the back house playing poker.
I don't know where that became like a new middle class Jewish tradition, but it was, right?
Yeah.
Like I remember and then she had her winnings and, you know, always just a thing of change.
Right. But, and then every year there's a new card in American Mahjong, which is different from Chinese Mahjong.
So this is like, is it a hipster Jew thing or is it just a hipster thing?
I don't know if it's a hipster thing. It's all the, you know, as a working mom, I was always looking for ways to sort of keep up on the gossip and
play
dates
friends.
And all that stuff. Yeah. And so the sisterhood was teaching Mahjong and I took lessons. And
like
then
the Jewish sisterhood.
Yeah. At the temple. And I learned to play and then I had a really regular game, but then two of the women in the game had a big fight and that fell apart.
At a Mahjong game?
Outside the Mahjong game, but it affected the game. It wasn't good. Yeah. Oh, but what I was saying before was my mom had this high stakes game on Saturday nights. And sometimes if my brothers were out, they couldn't get a babysitter. My dad would take me to this post house and put me in a soundproof booth to nap while he worked. That was another one of my
showbiz
stories. Yes, showbiz stories. But the Mahjong thing is amazing. It's so pleasing.
And, really?
Yeah.
I mean, I just remember the tiles being impressive.
They're really impressive, and it's also
exotic.
It's a really good balance of luck and skill.
Yeah, I have no idea what it is.
Yeah,
it's not like dominoes. Is it more like cards?
It's a little like gin, rummy cube, poker. Like you're making hands.
Yeah, I just remember there's a dragon tile.
Oh, there's three kinds of dragons. There's white, red, and
green. And I was like fascinated with the tiles, but it didn't go much deeper than that. Yeah. It was always a mysterious game.
Did your mom
game.
Have cards?
My grandma?
No, or your grandma have cards?
I don't remember. Yeah, I think there were there cards?
Because that's the big difference between American and Chinese. The Americans have short attention spans, so every year a new card of new hands comes out.
Oh, no, I don't know that
and
they
you
had
that. And play
that
card for the year, and the money goes to the...
Yeah.
Mahjong League.
Whatever it is, the Mahjong Association.
Yeah, but you can call them. It's like these women in New York, hello? And you can ask about rules or, you know, it's the best.
I'm glad they're doing something.
And actually, you know, if this is going out over the airwaves, I'm always looking for a game when I'm in New York because I'm there shooting a lot and I don't have a game.
You don't have a Mahjong game?
I don't have a game
this is so
set
funny.
Up in New York.
It's such a Jewish thing, memory to me.
Yeah.
Yeah, but you grew up pretty like in that, right?
I mean, we grew up.
Well, I mean, not religious,
Jew-y.
But right, middle Jewy, yeah.
Jewish as a cultural identity, certainly.
Right, your grandparents, like, are they from the East Coast or what?
Yeah, everyone is. My mom's from Brooklyn. My dad's from the Bronx. My dad's side, I think they were born on the Lower East Side. My mother's side came from, you know, that vague Russia, Poland.
Sure, yeah, I got that. Yeah. That's exactly what I got. I'm going to find out. Did you ever find out? They do some genealogy show that they wanted me to be on, so I did the thing. But
I did the 23andMe.
What'd you find?
Jew. Like, white Jew from Eastern Europe.
But that's all that doesn't track to, like, I was hoping that it tracks literally to the house.
I didn't get that specific. No? I don't know if they can find that much from saliva.
No, but was it Poland, or did you see?
It was, you know, the hard thing is there were such, you know, the borders kept changing, so...
Hard to know.
I don't know. It was somewhere with pogroms where they didn't like Jews and it was cold.
And so, they left.
Yes,
and they went to New York.
Yes.
And there you go.
Yes.
That's it.
Yes.
Well, that's not very exciting. I was hoping for more than that.
Sorry.
So you're a pain in the ass in school.
Totally.
And you pulled favor and you got Michael Jackson to... But were you going to shows that your dad produced? Was there something inspiring you
Rarely.
Really?
And I wasn't supposed to go into the business.
You weren't supposed to?
Uh-uh. I was either supposed to be a professional.
What does that mean?
Doctor, lawyer.
Oh, you know, right.
Or I was supposed to marry well. And my mother once told me I should go to Caltech and sit on a bench and meet an engineer. That was her big advice.
And your mother, was she an artist too?
She was a novelist. She wrote three novels.
Were they popular?
I think they did well in the 70s.
Yeah?
Yeah.
So was she writing a lot or no?
She was writing mostly while we were at summer camp. She'd ship us off for 8 weeks and we'd come back and there'd be a book.
Isn't that funny? That my parents did that too. And it was really so they could have time. It wasn't, I don't think it had anything to do with our happiness. Maybe yours, they're different, but like...
I liked camp.
Well, I liked camp, but like there was one summer I went to two camps.
Mm-hmm.
Like it was like, we're going to send you to this camp. And I was terrified
to be
away.
I've done that
with
my kids.
You have?
Yeah.
Two camps.
But they like camp.
Yeah,
my daughter went to three one summer, I think. But it was like things she wanted to do. So everything's so special.
What kind of camp
did
you go to?
clapping camp. You learn to clap rhythmically. No, it was Jewish camp in Malibu.
Yeah. Not too far. So not overnight camp. It really was a clapping camp?
No. There was just a lot of singing with clapping combinations.
Yeah, and kind of like groovy counselors.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Pretty groovy.
I went to a Jewish day camp. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then I went to a cowboy camp.
Ooh.
And I shot guns and fished
flies. My brothers had gone to the same Jewish camp and they didn't get into the leadership program because they were probably obnoxious. So they went to a different camp where, like, they slaughtered a pig and they did all these crazy. It was the opposite.
Yeah,
but they loved it.
Yeah, yeah. And then you become part. Like at those camps, there's always that one moment where someone finds out you're Jewish, and they're like, "Oh, you're one of them."
That one before.
Yeah, exactly. That definitely happened. Yeah. So when do you get to decide that you're not going to, you know, go sit on a bench and all that stuff? Did you, your brothers are, you have two brothers?
I have two brothers. They're twins.
And one of them's in show business?
Yeah. My brother David created Will and Grace.
So he won an Emmy.
Yeah.
And you won a couple Emmys.
I have an Emmy.
And your dad has Emmys.
Lots of Emmys. He's the big winner.
Yeah? But that's sort of amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Is he still around?
It's a dynasty. Yeah, he is.
He must be
He's
very
terrific.
Proud.
Oh, he is. It's
Does
really
he like
nice.
Your shows?
He does. There's an interesting thing about the Pride thing. He was standing on my brother's set. He was watching a taping one night. And there was a director who shall remain nameless next to him.
He created Will and Grace, your brother?
My brother did, yeah.
That was a big deal.
It was a big deal.
He's doing all right, that guy.
Yeah. And they're doing more now.
They are?
Yeah,
it's back?
Doing 10 more.
Isn't that odd that it's happens? I mean, it's nice, but are they starting now or are they just
pretend? Yeah, they're ready.
Okay. Yeah. But I mean, like, is it picking up where it left off or
I'm not sure. I think there was talk of sort of forgetting how they wrapped up the show and going back or going beyond it and saying, look how life brings us back to the same spot.
Yeah.
But my dad was standing watching his show and he was next to a director who turned to him and said, this must be killing you. And my father was appalled. He's like, are you kidding? This is what I dream of. This is all I ever wanted in my life. Why would this be killing me? I want my kids to do better than I do. And it was such a foreign notion to him that this guy would think that he'd be bitter about his son's success.
It said
a lot about the director, I think.
I think, and also maybe about what show business has become in a way. I don't know, because that just choked me up for some reason. Because that is like this traditional kind of idea of like you want your parents to succeed better than you. You're right. You want your children to do better. And so I think it's everyone's idea, but there was that idea of people who come from immigrants that kind of goes through, you know, the generations.
Oh, for
like
sure.
You always want them to do better than you, unless your parents are selfish assholes and feel threatened by your success.
Right. And again, that's why I think it was more about, but my fault. Are you kidding?
That's so great. Yeah. That's
no,
so sweet.
No, and he's always, you know, emailing me articles and you were mentioned here. And if
really?
Very, very sweet about it.
Well, that's nice because I don't think my father's listened to a podcast.
I don't think my mother has watched the show.
So someone.
But part of she can't hear and
really?
Can't get the Netflix to work in her room. I don't know what the problem
is. It's a big issue. Just the shift in technology, the next step or two steps that they have to take to do anything.
It's too much.
It is.
Yeah.
I don't understand that. But all right, so what do you do in college?
I wander around New York and
Where'd you go?
I went to Columbia.
Oh, really? That's fancy. That's not like a show business
school.
Well,
I transferred to Columbia. I didn't get in at first. I started at Brandeis, where I did
Still
not
good.
Want to be. Fine.
I had to start at Curry College.
Okay.
it had a very good program for dyslexics, and they were very open to, people whose parents had a little bread and would pay. I wasn't dyslexic. I was, problematic.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
I think
so,
I was problematic.
So, but Brandeis is sort of
so
your
Brandeis
entry level.
Was lovely in a lot of ways. I met really interesting people, took good classes. I could not deal with the isolation at all. It was outside of Boston. The train stopped running at 11.
Right.
I didn't have a car.
What was it in, like, Waltham? Waltham, right.
Where an old watch factory had shut down.
Yeah.
And I had always wanted to go to Columbia.
Yeah.
And I basically harangued them into letting me in.
It's a sister school, right?
No.
Barnard is the Columbia's other school. Right.
We were the sixth class of women, I think, to graduate from Columbia.
Oh, really?
But I just kept writing them every few weeks. Like, look, I won a writing contest. Have you changed your mind yet? You want me. And I hocked them into taking me.
Hocked? I haven't heard that word in a while. Oh, my God. What was it? What's the rest of that saying? My mother used to say it wrong.
Oh, something.
Hock me a chinic.
Yeah.
Don't hock me a chinic.
Yeah.
I know. So, all right. So you talk Columbia into letting you in the writing program?
No, I wasn't even an English major. I was in English concentration because I wanted to take so many classes and I didn't want to do them all like in English. So you were allowed to graduate with a concentration.
And what other stuff was interesting you?
I took an amazing shamanism class.
You don't have a shaman, do you?
I don't have a shaman, but my father had a guru
for years,
Miss Charlotte.
In the 70s?
70s, 80s, 90s, she died at like 103 or something. And he would go every Friday and do yoga and she would walk on his back and then they would talk. And if any of us were going to travel or do something, it's like, check in with Miss Charlotte.
You'd have to go check in with her?
Or he'd ask. And
oh,
he'd,
really?
He'd bring the messages. What,
was that an odd thing? Was your mother like, are you going to the lady?
No, it was just part of his. My dad was one of those guys, you saw them on corners in the 70s especially, of these guys who moved from New York, and they were now like all in white or in a tracksuit of some kind, and waiting for the light, looking up to the sun to try to get more tan, and just being so happy they were in L.A. And my father loved it. My mother never got over leaving New York.
Okay.
And
so he bought right into the whole lifestyle.
Yeah, but it was his way, and he'd meditate. I remember there's a picture of me in his lotus, like as a little girl lying while his eyes are up in his head and he's meditating.
Really?
Yeah.
But he wasn't like a, he was more like the, at the beginning of the new agey kind of movement.
Yeah.
Not like
a
hippie.
No.
No, just a part of the early California lifestyle.
Yeah.
He bought in. He liked it.
So we always had to check with Miss Charlotte.
Oh, did he have a convertible?
No.
It's not that important, but yeah. Miss Charlotte, huh? Mm-hmm. And did you know her?
Yeah, I went to Miss Charlotte a few times because she was...
What was her, like, what...
She was German. Charlotte Zutrauen.
Uh-huh. What was her credentials?
She had been the heir apparent to Yogananda, but had decided she didn't want to take over the...
Right.
...thing, so she sort of, I guess,
renegade?
Private practice.
Oh, okay. Well, that's okay. So you study shamanism and English and just well-rounded liberal arts education.
Really good liberal arts education. Yeah. Solid.
It means something, right?
Yeah.
That's what I did too. Like you want to learn things. You're curious. So you want to do things.
I have a kid who's starting in the fall and it's like, just go to school.
And how do you feel? Like how old? He's 18?
He's 17. He'll be 18 soon. Yeah.
How's he turning out?
He's awesome, which makes it even harder to, because he just, I mean, he didn't just, he's always been an interesting kid, but he's the best company. He's really funny. He's really smart. He's really in the world. And he's leaving. And he's one of my favorite people to hang out with. And it's sort of heartbreaking.
Don't you have some other ones?
I have two more. My daughter, though, is leaving in the fall for one semester. She's doing this thing called the mountain school where she's going to work on a farm and take classes.
Well, that's good.
So I'm losing two at once. I still have the little one.
So are you freaking out?
A little bit.
Oh, I can't imagine that.
Yeah.
I think it's one of the reasons I never had kids, aside from constant worry and dread.
Right.
The leaving thing. You're built into it.
It's, yeah.
Now you're going to.
And if you've done your job, they go on, they live their lives. Yeah. But I like them so much. I like them so much. And I like being around them. And
do you like your husband?
I like my husband.
Oh, good. So you guys will be.
Yeah. And we still have the caboose. And he's got a few years.
But like my question is like when you see like I think you're younger than me, but like there was, I know you are. But like there was this kind of compulsion when we were younger to learn about stuff like that. You know, the 60s were still not that far behind us. And there was this interest in all these different things. And I don't know anything about kids that age now or because there's so much available at all times.
It's all available at your fingertips.
Yeah.
It's a different and schools haven't adapted to that yet.
Mm-hmm.
There's still, and I guess there's benefit.
They're like
in
our
memorization.
Parents. They just haven't.
Yeah, they haven't quite gotten to that. But and you know, classic quote-unquote education is still the norm. Some places are getting more progressive, but everything, they don't have to research the same way we did.
Right.
They don't have to seek things out.
Yeah.
It's all available.
What's he interested in?
Well, that's the great thing. He used to be a real science-y kid, and then he worked in labs over the summer and realized it's not for him. So he's wide open right now, which I think is really cool.
Yeah. Oh, man. I like everyone always talks so negatively about that generation. And I want to have hope and I want to feel
but
like
they're the generation after millennials, kids.
So now.
So they're awesome.
They're analog. They're back to analog.
Yeah. It's like, I think Gen Z.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And how are they different, do you think?
I think they're left. Theoretically, they're less
selfish-centered.
Yeah, they want to. They're workers. They
want to help and they want to get involved.
Yeah,
sensitive. They're back. They've gone through the narcissistic tunnel, and now we're back at.
Hopefully.
I hope so. Jesus. So all right. So what happens? Because I guess what I want to track a little is how one. Yeah, I've talked to other people in show business, but. In terms of becoming a producer from a writer and stuff, where does that start? When did you graduate and then what, you come back out here?
I came back out here. I didn't mean to. I drove across country with a friend and I thought, I'll get off somewhere and I'll waitress write a novel.
You did all the things.
Yeah.
So you wanted to write fiction?
Yeah. I'd had success writing fiction in college. When I was out of money, I'd enter contests and I'd get $200.
Really? Yeah. Like short stories?
Short stories.
Who's your favorite writers?
I mean, I love Cheever and I love Carver and I love
Cheever. Did you ever see that film, the adaptation, The Swimmer?
I didn't see the film. How was it? I love the story.
It's brutal.
I don't know, because I see the story so clearly in my head. I don't know if I want to.
Well, it's Burt Lancaster, yeah. I think, playing this. He's just like this weirdly empty, beaten kind of guy.
You know what? Actually, I'm wrong. I did see it now that you said Burt Lancaster.
Yeah. And
yes.
It's a very weird kind of movie.
Yeah.
Like, because you don't really put it all together that he's swimming through, you know, the wreckage of his life
right.
in some way. And it's just, it's kind of devastating. It's a weird little movie.
It's amazing.
Cheever, and who'd you say?
Carver.
Oh, yeah.
I liked writing short stories. I tried a playwriting class. I was told I was terrible.
Yeah.
And...
So you were gonna, your romantic vision was like, I'll just get out and live an American
right.
life
right.
amongst the people.
Right.
And write, heartfelt, earnest, dark stories.
I don't
stories.
Know necessarily earnest, but yeah.
Were you always comedic?
I think I'm better on the page than in person. I think funny and I write funny.
Yeah. Because Carver makes sense to me.
Yeah.
Heading into what you ultimately did. Right?
Yeah. I mean, I read everything when I was younger, so I think there's influences from all over.
But not like you weren't like a Philip Roth thing? Was that more of a guy thing?
I read Philip Roth. I read, and Morgan Stern is a great character. And, it's fun to hear about the other side and the
yeah.
masturbation. And
yeah. What you guys do.
Yeah, what you guys do, which I've learned about. A lot. Since
you got a son
time.
Now.
I have two sons.
Yeah. So, yeah.
They're very fond of their penises, yes. But why not?
Why wouldn't you be?
Mm-hmm.
So, okay, so you don't get off in middle America.
I don't get off. I come back to LA. I'm working.
Back with your parents?
For like 2 weeks. And then I take my bat mitzvah money and I get an apartment. Yeah.
You put that you were able to do first, last, and security with the bat mitzvah money?
I don't think, yes, at that point.
I found some old U.S., the Treasury bonds.
Yes.
They're worth nothing.
No.
And I had some Israeli bonds that, like, I think I got when I was born or something that
right.
I found. They're nothing. They're nothing.
Yeah.
Yeah. You think, like, this has been, it's been 40 years.
No.
I'm going to be a millionaire.
Yeah, yeah. It's like it's $18 because it's high. Yeah. No, it's not.
Very disappointing.
Yeah.
All right. So where'd you get the apartment?
I got an apartment in West Hollywood, which was a great little studio, but it was down the street from a strip club. It was the one on Sunset. Near,
mm-hmm. Near the Comedy Store? The one that has the nude?
Girls, 18,
yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But the problem was I was working and I would come home late and the entire street was parked up and I'd be so exhausted and I'd be circling and crying. So
yeah.
That
leads to stripping if you're not careful.
Exactly.
Circling and crying.
Exactly. But I can't do pole.
You can't,
so I have almost all the elements. So yeah, I was living there and I was working crappy jobs and I was
in show business?
No. I worked at I wrote the blurbs, restaurant blurbs, the LA Weekly for a little bit. I worked at I Love Juicy.
Yeah.
Which was a vegan restaurant in Venice.
Oh my God, you drove all the way down there?
Well, I wanted to get, part of my, when I moved back, I wanted to know the city. So
right.
I was, and also at that time, my goal, I was going to be a spoken word performance artist.
What year is this?
80s? 91.
Oh yeah?
Yeah.
So that was when the slam poetry thing was starting?
It wasn't so much slam poetry. Like in New York, I was obsessed with Joe Frank and the Dark, like the radio thing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it was the time of Laurie Anderson and Eric Bogosian and Spalding Gray and
yeah.
all these people who could sit on a stage with a desk and capture an audience for 2 hours.
That, like Spalding, I saw him do Swimming to Cambodia Monster in a Box, I think. He was astounding.
And I worked in a performance art gallery in Tribeca called the Franklin Furnace. I was the intern.
Really?
And so that was going to be my thing. I was going to be, and it's such a bad idea because I'm really nasal, I'm blinky, I'm not comfortable on stage, and I much rather hide behind fiction, and it's so exposed. But at that time, that was the big goal. And it was, so I was working at a performance art magazine downtown called High Performance.
I remember that magazine.
Yeah. And then in the Valley was the Reader, and then in Venice was the Juice Place. And I was running around. And then eventually...
Did that really translate here? Were there people doing that in L.A.? Like at that level?
Yeah, to some extent.
Yeah?
Chris Burton was out here, I think.
Uh-huh.
Because
seeing Spalding or Eric or...
But they would all come through town. And certainly Joe Frank was based here.
I just started learning about him. I learned about him through Ira Glass.
Oh, I was obsessed.
Yeah?
I was
obsessed. It was like the beginning of a certain type of radio.
It was
right?
amazing. And I lived in New York. I didn't get housing senior year, and I lived in a welfare hotel. And it was just this not a happy place. So, but I'd sit in my room where I had contact paper to every surface, and I'd listen to Joe Frank through a station in New Jersey.
Yeah.
And I was in love.
Did you ever meet him?
No.
He's still around.
Someone
just emailed me that I should interview him. I got to get up to speed on him. I'm very bad at getting... I don't know where people find time to do anything.
Yeah.
If you don't do it when you're that age, like where things are planting, like now as we get older, it's like, who the fuck has the time to do anything?
But it's hard because you have to keep inputting.
You do.
And I feel like there's a deficit right now. I need to definitely input more because my output is...
Get tapped out.
Yeah.
I get belligerent too as I get older because everything seems like a pain in the ass. Like, you know, you want to go to the museum. I'm like, oh, what is it?
Right. Right. And how do you force yourself? There's so much to watch on television.
I don't even know how, I do a bunch of material on it in my stand-up now about that. Just being like, you know, like the idea that people tell me, ask me if I've seen a show, and not only have I not heard of the show, when they tell me where it's on, I don't know what that is.
Right.
What is that?
Right.
I'm like, I'm not my parents, but there's another thing. But I don't think everybody knows all that stuff. Everyone picks their thing and they do it.
Well, that's how I know how my kids don't care what platform it's on.
Right.
It's just, I know I want to watch this. Where is it?
Right.
And I'll go wherever it is. There's not necessarily brand loyalty on this.
All right. So performance art, decide
right,
not to.
Right.
Frank. So you got a brain full of.
I love all this stuff. But
it's gritty stuff you like.
Yeah. Yeah. And just stories. I mean, but stories are primal, you know? It's.
What do you mean?
I just think when my kids were babies.
Yeah.
I remember they'd start. I have an amazing nanny who was a master of distraction.
Yeah.
And they'd start to get fussy or moody, and she'd say, "Did you hear about the puppy?" And like start telling the story, and they'd switch, and it was the power of narrative.
Yeah.
It's something so basic. It's like, oh, I want to hear what happened with the puppy.
Right.
And we all love stories. And I think that's the explosion in podcasts. So many are just, you can sit and listen to stories.
Yeah. I guess it's always been that way. What else do you have?
And
it's like oral tradition.
Tell me a story.
Yeah.
There was apparently, they found a campfire site from millions of years ago, and they found popcorn kernels. Like, people had been eating popcorn and sort of watching the fire show and telling stories.
Hanging out.
I love that idea. Popcorn is eternal.
So you realize that, you know, it was storytelling that you were attracted by, not getting on stage.
No.
Engaged.
I'm not a performer.
But engaged storytelling.
Yes.
I mean, because Jesus, like between Eric and Spalding, I mean, that is some manic business.
Yeah.
You know,
and later, like Danny Hawk, and there were a lot of people.
He did more characters, right? I kind of like, I didn't like, well, Eric did characters, but he never got that far away from himself.
He was a storyteller, and Spalding was a genius storyteller, and Laurie Anderson was like
out there, like
it was
ethereal.
It was kind of an amazing, and Karen Finley was shoving potatoes up her ass.
You saw that?
I didn't see it.
She was a little earlier, right?
Yeah, but she had been at the furnace, and she'd been places that,
right,
but I hadn't,
because like by the time you were there, it was already the original crew. It's because I got to New York in the 80s, and like, you know, you're on the Lower East Side, and you're like, this is where it happens. It's like, well, it happened,
right?
You know, now there's just a repetition of people trying to hold on.
There
to
was
the
some interesting shows.
Oh, of course.
Yeah.
I saw some wild shit there. So when do you start getting into show business?
When I, you know, the whole rebellion thing again, when I'm told I can't.
Right. But did you tap out on, like, you know, chasing the poetry dream and that kind of stuff, spoken word stuff?
I wasn't sure what I was going to do. And I was working these weird jobs. And then I was PAing on some things.
That's always the entry point, the PA thing.
And I PA'd for Jay Tarsus because I had been obsessed with the Days and Nights of Molly Dodd.
Yeah.
It was my favorite show.
Yeah.
And and he was just grumpy.
Yeah.
Just like, don't meet your heroes.
Yeah,
so,
right.
So I was seeing someone at the time whose friend was having success in showbiz, his friend from summer camp.
Yeah.
And I said, maybe I should try that. I've always written, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And he told me, you have a better chance of being elected to Congress than getting on the staff of a TV show, which was all I needed.
Yeah, a fight.
Yeah, I left my job and I moved up to Santa Cruz for a little while. One of my best friends was studying for her medical boards. And
at UC Santa Cruz?
She'd gone to, yeah, she was trying to get into med school.
That's such a trippy little town.
Yeah, and she had a little house and we'd go to coffee shops and I'd work on my scripts because I had, you know, taped things off TV and watched them.
So you're working on spec scripts.
I'm working on spec scripts and she's studying for her boards and now she's a doctor and I'm still writing. No, but.
You're both doing all right.
Yeah, we're doing okay.
Yeah.
And then we just have sort of hippie adventures in Santa Cruz, sure. Which was awesome. Yeah. And I came back with these specs.
Yeah, for what?
I had a Seinfeld and a Simpsons.
Yeah.
And my ex-sister-in-law's father gave them to my first agent in an elevator. They worked in the same building.
Uh-huh.
And he read them.
Second use of connection.
Yes,
Michael
exactly.
Michael Jackson, defense, and this.
And my ex-sister-in-law's father. And then he said, I can't do with the animated. Then I wrote a Roseanne. And he sent me out. And I was on staff by spring.
For who?
The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air.
You were in the room.
First job.
Really?
Yeah.
That was a big show.
It was a big show, a happy stage, a miserable upstairs.
Really?
It was a
Which
rough,
means the writer's room?
Yeah, it was a rough room.
That's what it's called, the upstairs?
Yeah. I guess. I mean, in that configuration, the writer's room.
But that's one of those stories where, like, because I got guys who wrote on Marin who were, you know, sort of veterans of rooms.
Yeah.
And, you know, there was a period there, and I imagine it still exists, but probably not to the degree it did, where the showrunners could be just fucking monsters.
The showrunner at the time was going through divorce, so he never wanted to go home.
So he made everybody stay.
We stayed forever. He was a little bit of a drinker. I don't know if he knew this, but someone on staff was peeing in his tequila, and he kept getting the flu.
Oh my God.
It was not pretty.
That is not a good writer's room.
No, it was. There was a lot of really messed up stuff. And having had that experience, I felt like I need to write my own stuff. Like, right then, I knew I wanted a side door or something.
But you knew, did you learn that first job, the way it worked? How people, because like it becomes very clear that like, well, the showrunner's the job, the creator's the job.
Right.
You know, you're not going to.
Be careful what you wish for.
Right. Right, but like, you know, that's the career. Mm-hmm. You know, to be, you know, just a staffer, you know, for life is rough.
It is rough. And I knew I wanted to have kids.
Yeah.
And it was not going to happen unless I could control the production.
Yeah, so what's the next job?
So I write a pilot about 20-somethings, and I get hired onto Friends.
You did?
Yes, first season. And I was literally put in the copy room at a little and snack room at a little desk. And I was the age of the characters, and you know, the showrunners were older.
Yeah.
And I was full of enthusiasm, and I gave them everything I could, and I got fired.
Within the first season?
Yeah, at the end, yeah.
Why? Do you know? And you didn't do a script?
I did do a script. And I should have taken it to arbitration because they took my name off it and I'm really upset about it. But look, you learn along the way.
It's like that's the other thing about writing is that the, you know, because even when you like there, it is really, you know, people write the way it works is, you know, the outline process and then you break down, you break the story, the outline process, and then it's assigned.
Right.
And then it like can be like taken away.
Right,
It's very hard to credit people properly.
Yes. And I think people don't understand that just because someone's name is on a script, like I hear in Ryan Murphy's camp, they just take turns putting their names on scripts just to get paid that week. You know? And it's
that seems fair, but it's still a little weird because
it's weird.
Because really it's a collaborative effort all the way
through. Very
much so. I mean, you should just list all the writers on everything, but then you know people don't get the right insurance.
Right, exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
All right, so you do the Friends thing that
and
doesn't
it was,
work.
Yeah, and it sort of soured me on the whole show business thing. So I went to Nepal to trek.
Really?
And I had researched online, which was the very beginning of online. And I was going to meet up with this group. And I show up and I'm like 23.
Yeah.
And everyone's in their 50s and 60s. But they, you know, they had a good pace. And I would I would walk on my own and then meet up with people for dinner. And I heard all about their grandkids. And I realized that showbiz wasn't out of my system because I wrote a Frasier in Nepal.
In Nepal?
Yeah. So
you weren't, you didn't get the spiritual enlightenment?
I loved the walking, and it was pretty, and it was exotic, but I needed to continue my real life, I guess.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Well, you wanted to win show business.
I wanted to win show business. Yeah.
And did they make the Frasier?
They didn't. The specs, they never made specs. Mm-hmm. It was a legal thing. Specs were to show that you knew how to copy the voice.
Right.
Of,
oh, that's right. I guess that, they wanted to see that you could write.
Right. And what I started doing every year was writing pilots while staffing on shows. But when I got back,
I got a stack of pilots?
I have, I think, 15 or 17 pilots in a drawer. You got to keep buying your lottery tickets.
Yeah.
When I got back, I got the best job from that same, I think, 20-something script of my life, which really taught me that rooms can be healthy and productive and creative. Yeah. And that was for Tracy Ullman on Tracy Takes On.
How'd you meet her?
She read my stuff. I got called in for an interview, and I got the job.
As a writer.
Yeah. And it was a great staff, a lot of veterans, and truly funny.
And that was sort of an exciting show because she was this versatile performance artist, really.
She was phenomenal.
Yeah.
And that was the thing. Everything you gave her, even if it wasn't going to make it, she delivered. And every Wednesday, we'd read through the scripts out loud and read through the sketches. And I was soon relegated to stage directions because I would tank everyone's jokes, including my own. I'm not an actress.
Yeah.
But it was healthy and it was happy.
Yeah.
And it was, we work, and then you go home and you have your life. And I was also obsessed with Domino's at the time, so I was leaving work and going to Venice to play with the
Oh, really?
Guys,
so you've got a thing
court.
For tile games.
Well, I learned on Fresh Prince how to play.
Yeah.
And I got really into it.
Yeah.
So I went down. I was looking for a game.
Yeah.
And I found one at the basketball courts in Venice. And it became like this whole thing. Because theoretically, if you keep score, they let you sit down next.
Yeah.
And they kept taking my seat and not letting me sit down.
Oh.
And then finally, I kept coming. They let me sit down, and I could actually play. And I knew all the slang because I'd been taught on Fresh Prince. And I was quiet fire.
Character.
Oh, I loved it. I loved it. And I met amazing people. And it was also during OJ and all that stuff. It was a really interesting time to
hear the reflections on the street.
Yes. Yes.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. And what? Yeah. What were their arguments? In that community?
Can I swear? I don't know.
Yeah.
Okay. So, we'd be sitting and they'd be talking about it, and they'd be like, motherfuckers, guilty, blah, blah, blah. Yeah. And then cops would pass by and they'd yell, no justice, no peace. And it was just, okay. and that game ended actually because they kept breaking tables because when you had a really good bone, you'd slam it sometimes. And the rec department just stopped replacing the tables.
And that's when the game went away?
So
on Tracy, what was, she was a good leader.
She was amazing. She was amazing. Everyone would talk for a long time, and then we'd figure out our theme or whatever, and everyone would go off and write. And as I said, on Wednesdays, you'd come back, and she'd perform all the sketches out loud with the writers as the other parts, and there'd be wine with lunch.
Yeah.
And she made everything come alive. And
this is, really dealing, but that's thematic or become something you're known for, but that is a woman driving the show with, and dealing with issues that are specifically, women's issues and women's
and
character.
And being in front of the camera, which is amazing.
And being hilarious.
Yes.
All right, so you do 3 years with Tracy. Are you still in touch with her?
Sometimes.
She all right?
She's great. I mean, she's great.
Oh, good, good. And are you a showrunner or just a writer?
Oh, I'm the baby in that room.
Okay.
And
So you get a producer's credit after a year?
No, there's a whole pecking order. It's staff writer, story editor, co-producer, producer, supervising producer, co-exec, and exec.
A lot of those don't entail jobs.
No, a lot of them don't entail jobs. It's just a money bump.
Right.
And you're climbing the ladder.
Right, yeah. So you were just a writer?
I was just a writer.
All right.
I might have gone up to producer. I think I did.
Yeah. But your job
was
you were a writer.
Yes.
And then what happens after that?
I keep going back to Tracy, but I take other jobs in between.
Yeah.
And I did a short-lived WB show, which was another good lesson sort of.
What was that?
First time out. out.
Yeah.
I think.
You just took
Jackie
a gig.
Guerra.
Yeah. Oh, right. Yeah. Well, I think my friend Craig Anton was.
He was.
Yeah.
And it was, that was actually a friendly room. And the showrunner lived in Colorado and was going back and forth and trying to make it work. So sometimes he wouldn't be there and the whole room would sort of take turns
being
it was very hard to pull off as a quality show, but we all learned how to sort of
do the job,
which was really nice
because the guy wanted to be in Colorado.
Yeah,
who can that blame worked him?
Out. It's very pretty in Colorado.
That's interesting. So what, you know, what was the job when you think about it at that moment? Like, it's your turn. You just
You are the head coach.
Right.
In the writer's room.
Yeah.
You are saying, we're going to work on this now. This outline's missing stuff. You know.
And
it really was fairly democratic. We were.
Wow.
We took turns and they were nice people in that room. And I had come out of other rooms that were not very nice. So between Tracy and that, it was very healing, especially Tracy as a role model, incredible role model.
Yeah.
And then. I did Mad About You. I did a year on Gilmore Girls.
That was a big show. People loved that show.
Yeah.
Did you love it?
Which?
Gilmore Girls?
Gilmore Girls was complicated because it's Amy's show.
Yeah.
And they forced her to have a staff. Uh-huh. And she really didn't want one. And so she would never come in the room.
Yeah.
And, or she'd come in and say, all right, well, give me some ideas. And then she'd go, and she wrote that show.
Yeah.
And I felt bad. It was almost like, why? I understand that the studio wants insurance, but it should have been her way. It was her show.
Yeah. Right despite that, right?
It did great. She took help, but the first year, I don't think she knew how, and she was still raging because they sort of shoved the staff down her throat, so it was a little hard.
It's always amazing to me that there are people, like when you hear about these guys, like, you know, just the fight to keep these successful shows going and the ego is necessary. It's like, I got an ego, but like, I don't have the commitment or the discipline to be that.
But there's a lot of ways to do it.
Oh, I know. You do it in a very nice way.
I mean, the third thing that showed me how to run a nice show was Peter Tolan.
He's like a genius, right? That guy?
Unbelievable, really kind, but an asshole to the right people.
Right.
Like, Papa Hen, you know, he protected his staff.
What was his big thing that made him so, like, was he?
Oh, the Dennis Leary.
Well, no, before that. Like, he was a known guy, right?
Yes, he was.
I can't remember, like, because, like, yeah, either. Dennis, he did Rescue Me, and he did the other one, too, I think. He's worked with Dennis a lot, but he came from, like, was it Cheers, maybe, or something?
Maybe. I don't know, but he was
What
fantastic.
Show was that you were working on?
It was called, like, Wednesdays 8:30, 9:30 Central, or something like that. It had a terrible title, and it was basically a send-up of execs, so it was not going over well behind the scenes.
Yeah.
But Peter was... It was the first time I got rewritten where it was better.
Oh, really?
Very often it's a lateral move or pissing in the corners.
Right.
And Peter Tolan was a genius and
Murphy
kind
Brown.
And fun. Yeah. And it's like, wow, everything. He made it better. I understand why. And it was enlightening. And you didn't resent it because this... Like,
you couldn't argue with it.
No.
But the first moment was sort of like, well, what's this guy got? And then you're like, oh, shit.
Yeah. I remember I had written some line about someone's ass.
Yeah.
I don't even remember what my line is. But he changed it to flat and wide like Kansas. And sometimes he'd play the piano in the room. And he was just delightful.
So you got lucky with a string of
people. I
got
lucky with some. And then, you know, there were other dysfunctionals. The year I'm Mad About You was not particularly functional year.
Was it towards the end? Or
middle to end. But every year while I was staffing, I was also writing pilots.
Yeah.
And making script deals and writing more pilots.
So when was the first your show? When was the first Jenji Cohen show?
There was an ABC show we developed. I can't remember if we shot it or not.
Wow.
And then there was a CBS show that went for like six, which was a disaster.
What was that?
It was about children of adult parents who are divorcing and how it affected.
And you created it?
I did.
And can't remember the name?
It was a terrible experience.
Who was in it?
An amazing cast. Yeah. It was Judith Light, Robert Klein. One of the Judd Apatow gang was one of the kids. And what happened was I wrote this pilot.
Oh, okay. The Stones.
Yes, that was it.
Jay Baruchel.
Yes, Jay Baruchel, who is really fun and has a Maple Leaf tattoo.
He's kind of interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's a, like, I like that guy.
And Lindsay Sloan,
yeah.
Who we underserved.
And it just, what?
What happened was this, and it was terrible. It was a Warner Brothers show, and I had written the pilot, and they had bought it, and they felt I wasn't seasoned enough. And so they brought on my brother and Max to guide Muchnick, his partner, to oversee.
Ugh.
And which was really galling because I had started writing in television while David was still an assistant.
Yeah.
But he had this meteoric rise.
Your brother.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, and I thought, all right, they'll let me do my thing. And it did not work that way. And one weekend they rewrote the pilot. And
so now this is causing family problems.
Huge. And I realized I was intruding on a marriage. You know, David and Max were this unit, and it was very threatening to Max, certainly. And it was a disaster. And it was, looking back, I should have quit. I should have left. It was totally painful, and it affected my relationship with my brother for a lot of years.
Really?
Who I was very close with.
Oh.
Now we have breakfast every Friday now. It's good again. But it was sort of devastating. And that's when I went to cable, and it was just, I traded money for freedom.
And that's with Weeds.
That started with Weeds, yeah.
Now, how long did that sprint, was that one of the pilots that you had done?
No, I remember, when I would pitch, I had a scattershot method.
Yeah.
And I would, how about this? And it was like one-liners.
Yeah.
And Weeds was suburban widowed pot-dealing mom.
Yeah.
And go with it.
Where did that come from? Where did that, like, do you know? I mean, that's a very Carver-like story.
Yeah, yeah. I'm not sure. I was very attracted to, and still am, the gray areas. I hated the idea of heroes and villains.
Sure.
And, you know, I'd grown up in L.A. I knew a lot of mom pot dealers.
Yeah. Oh, you did, yeah.
Yeah. I remember going to a friend's house and opening the vegetable crispers and seeing bags. And I think one of my brothers tried to grow in his closet for a while. Mm. But
before hydroponics, before the lights and everything.
Yeah. Yeah.
The good stuff.
Yeah.
So that took.
That took. And And the first year of that was rough because I went in saying, look, I've traded my network career. I'm going to do this my way.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of friction with the network and not the network.
It was Showtime? Who did it?
Yes, Showtime. Yeah. Friction with the network. And some friction with Mary Louise. But my attitude was, I'm not relinquishing control this time. This is my
I mean, how does that friction happen? I understand, like, a first season, everyone's kind of, like, looking for their territory and looking for their peace and their control and their voice in it, right? But, I mean, obviously it leveled off. But, I mean...
Yes, in success, everything gets better. But until they know, they're up your ass. And so...
Because they want to trust you, but they don't.
Of course.
And in show business, there's no reason to necessarily, unless someone's got an incredible pedigree of some kind.
Right. And even then, everyone has a fluff at one point. But I'd get notes from Showtime, and I'd write these long emails explaining note per note why I was not taking the note.
Yeah.
And I think it got very frustrating. And at one point, I just got an email back that said, fine, do what you want. And I think the intention of it was to say, no, I'm sorry, let's work together.
Yeah.
And I took it as a carte blanche. Thank you, I will. It's done.
Well, it could have been the other thing. It's like, well, fuck her.
Mm-hmm.
Let her fail. And we wash our hands of it.
Right.
We did what we could. But you did. You're like, yay.
Yeah. No, it was great. And I had a great staff.
I think in like, if you really think about it, the historically in dealing with executives, if they wash their hands of you, it's usually not a good side. But you just took it as like,
it was the best. It was the best.
Now, okay, there's another question. Like, you know, starting with Weeds, is that, and this is always a question I have because, you know, having the little experience I had at writing my own show, and also with doing Glow, which is my first real acting job on a series, as not me for the most part.
Mm-hmm.
Is that, you know, because Weeds goes a lot of places. Like, I mean, locations, you know, characters. I mean, it's all, like, literally, you're crossing continents.
Right.
Now, do you know that at the beginning?
No, no.
But some people do, right?
Some people definitely do.
Some people have a Bible.
Yes.
And they like, and I always wonder who those
first
people
of all, I never want a Bible because it locks you into things and it should be more malleable.
And also you get to know the characters and, you know, and as they evolve and become who they are in front of you,
right,
you're like, well, now we know what we can do with this person.
Right. Exactly.
Because like on Glow, I noticed that like once they got the hang of me as an actor and as a person and what I was doing with that guy, they could write for me because they were still writing.
Oh, we heard your voice in our heads. You were crystal clear. And the sound of you was had right, penetrated the cortex,
yeah,
which was awesome. I do every show 1 year at a time.
Yeah.
I'm not thinking about the future. I don't know what the future is. Let's focus on this season, where we're going to end.
Yeah.
And go from there.
And that went for 8 seasons.
Yeah.
And it was great. Everybody, like, you know.
It was lovely.
Yeah. And you were happy with it? You were happy with the way it ended and everything else?
Yeah, I was. That's I was sad that it ended.
Because you built a real family, right?
I built a family. I was running the production the way I wanted. And I was experienced enough to know that this is as good as it gets.
Right.
Like, I'd created an environment and a show where I had learned from mistakes of the past. I had learned from shows what I didn't want to do, what I did want to do. And even though it gets exhausting to keep writing the same show or with same characters, I knew how good I had it, and I was really nervous to let that go.
Did you let it go? Did you stop it?
No, they did.
Yeah.
And 8 years is a good run.
Yeah, definitely.
But everyone in the room was like, quick, write another show because when you don't have something on the air, you disappear. You're back to zero. And I was panicked. And so while I was doing Weeds, I had gotten Orange. And toward the end, when we were doing the finale, I was running up and downstairs to 2 different writers' rooms, starting Orange and finishing Weeds.
Yeah.
And in a way, I feel like I didn't get to mourn. I didn't have time.
Yeah.
And I kind of regret that because there's grief with the ending and spending 8 years of your life. And the whole point of Orange had been to bring the whole Weeds crew over. And then we had a shoot in New York. And it was really difficult.
How many went?
Very few, because you got to hire local crews.
Yeah.
I had Carly and Steven came on in different
Carly, the
years.
Co-creator
Carly
Mack, of
Glow. And Steven Falk, who does You're the Worst.
Yeah.
Who's terrific. Yeah, and it was sort of heartbreaking, but I couldn't deal with that because there was a new baby.
Yeah.
And I had to take care of the new baby. And then there was a little rivalry between the rooms. You like them better.
Oh, really?
It's interesting.
Yeah. So what was the seed for Orange?
Orange, a friend of mine had sent me the book to read on vacation. She lived in Brooklyn. She knew Piper and Larry.
Yeah.
And I read it, and I loved the characters. And I was always looking for these crossroads where people who would never ordinarily meet are forced to deal with one another. That was, very often that happens in underground economies, in Weeds, and that was completely the situation in Orange.
And like, what is compelling about that to you?
I love the confrontation with the other.
Yeah.
I love forcing that.
Yeah.
Because I think it's enlightening. I think it's the only way you really make progress.
And also in these, you know, in the outlaw territories, it's not, you don't have to hide much.
Right.
Because, you know, everyone knows the truth to a certain degree, not unlike an office situation.
Right.
Like, you're always meeting, you know, new people and having to deal with new people, but you have to play by these set of rules.
Right.
Where the, you know, and honor
and
the business.
Just paths crossing. I think we live more and more in a mosaic world, and you don't go over your chip, you know, and
right. This
forces people to deal. I remember getting some criticism on Weeds because why do the black people have to be drug dealers? I was like, the white people are drug dealers. They're all drug dealers. It's not specific.
How do you like the, how much criticism like that do you, I mean, I don't imagine you get it with Orange, but like, it's like, isn't there like a line with what is fundamentally progressive criticism?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that doesn't take into mind that some things are situational. Counterproductive sometimes?
Absolutely. Look, I'm not necessarily politically correct.
Right.
And I'm okay with that.
Yeah.
And, you know, I want to invest in my shows and my characters and what I find funny and what the room likes. And
are you getting critical emails from the prison population?
Not particularly. It was interesting because I was visiting a prison where, and I was meeting a bunch of people, uh-huh. and they were being very cagey, sort of intimating that they'd seen the show, but they couldn't claim they'd seen it because then people would know they had an illegal cell phone.
Oh,
so it was like, oh, I've heard about that, you know, but and we really like it, but. Then they couldn't. They'd blow their.
Have you gotten feedback from the prison industrial complex in any way?
You know, actually, interestingly enough, a lot of guards watch the show and like it. People, when they get out, we hear things.
Yeah, like what?
Well, one of the scary things is I have stories. Don't you want my stories? It's like, no.
Yeah, can't. Right. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's
yeah.
a legal gray area. But just you really captured it.
Oh, good.
You did well. And other times. You know, everyone has a different experience, and some people, that's not it at all. Sorry.
Yeah. That wasn't my experience.
Right.
It was a different prison I was in.
Right.
But also, like, you know, like, in terms of dealing with, I mean, I have to assume that you are being credited with this, like, you employ a lot of women.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? But just by virtue of the show, it doesn't feel like a mission.
No, it's what I think is the normalization of it. It's yeah. not... And before your gender, it's about talent.
Right.
That's the and I'll take talent in any package.
Sure, but you wrote a lot of female characters.
Oh, so, absolutely.
I mean, so yeah.
Well,
so,
also I had this source material that was in a women's prison. There was
and also I think you were the first to really deal aggressively and honestly and uniquely with trans issues. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
you know, that was a big deal.
Yeah.
And it was more accessible than what Jill was doing later. You know, like it completely made sense.
But didn't Jill invent trans?
No.
I'm kidding.
Now, according to a small group.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, that like the weird thing about Soloway's thing is like the story was so bizarre it had to be real. And mm-hmm. when you find out it's real, it's like, whoa, you know, like.
Well, it was interesting because like a year before Transparent, we'd gone to the desert for like an arts and crafts thing with
you
our
and
kids.
Jill. Oh, you.
Jill was there, and I was there, and a bunch of people.
Oh,
were
you
there.
Guys are buddies.
We've known each other for a long time. And after the kids went to sleep, we played this game called Family Secrets.
Yeah.
Where people write things and put them in a hat, and you pull it out, and you try to figure out whose it is, and if you can't, you put it back. Whatever. Someone pulls out a slip of paper.
Yeah.
It said, my father is currently living as a woman named Carrie.
Yeah.
And we're like, oh my God, who is this? This is amazing. And it turned out to be Jill. And it was a great quote. She said, look, as a child, oh my God. As a writer, oh my God. And it was fabulous because you could see the wheels were already turning and she had said, you know, she was always writing these pilots where a sister was missing or a family member was missing, and she said, maybe I internalized this and I knew on some level.
That there was a denial there. That mm-hmm. like it was a truth that couldn't be told.
I guess.
Huh. But all right, so the idea that it's not the agenda is not like I'm gonna work with women. This is
no,
a feminist
no.
idea.
In fact, I was actively discouraged because I mean, infamously, mm-hmm. you know, I did not have the best relationship with my lead in Weeds, although it got better.
Yeah.
And the whole room was like, write a show about guys, write all guys. And it was the Desperate Housewives era, and it was like, you do not want that situation.
Right.
But I'm glad I didn't believe it.
Well, that's a specifically, you know, male perception of that.
Sure.
And it's situational, I imagine, like, because it seems that with Orange that you've got another real community there.
Totally.
You know, and alumni.
We set it up that way. I mean, it was a lot of it was very deliberate in, because it was such a huge cast. There's a lot of women, a lot of people for whom it was their first TV job.
Yeah.
And we set a tone of like, this is a group, this is a family,
right.
You support each other, you compete for the work, you know,
right.
competitively in the scenes.
Right.
And it was sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy, and they bonded and they support each other's work outside the show and they make each other better in scenes. And It's amazing.
Well, I think that's the weird bad rap. These ideas that, you know, women are worse than men with fighting and this and that, and I don't know any of that. I didn't grow up with sisters. My only experience with a lot of women is on GLOW.
How did it go for you?
It was great.
Yeah.
I'm not that right away. I realized like, well, I can't sit with them.
Oh no.
No, not in a bad way. But like there was an intensity, an energy to, you know, 12 to 14 women sitting, you know, between takes together, you know, talking. Like I was just like, I'm going to be exhausted.
Uh-huh. Like, that's not untrue. Yes.
Right. It was just a matter of me. Like, I got to stay in this guy. You know, my boundaries aren't that great.
Right.
You know, holding the character is about all I can do. And if I go over there, I'm just going to be, emotionally shredded.
But that's also an actor thing. There are some actors I find who thrive on that energy and others who have to.
But I also knew that I had to have a certain, like, that whatever control I thought I had over that situation as a character was pretty tenuous.
It would be undermined if you were in the middle.
Well, yeah, because it was already, being undermined. And
right.
I couldn't admit it, but I got to know everybody, and it was very moving to me. Just because I'm pretty emotional, and that just to see, like, if I go to a musical, for no other reason than there are a lot of people singing, I'm crying.
Right.
So like, when they got in that ring, even for, once the first scene, which is the fight with Betty and Allison, that's a real fight.
Mm-hmm.
I was like choked up.
Right.
Because it's intense, and it has the ring has an intensity.
Right.
All right, so how did that, what was the process of GLOW happening?
So I'd work with Carly on both Weeds and Orange, and I think she's wildly talented. I'm a fan. And she went to work on Nurse Jackie for 1 or 2 years and met Liz. And they had watched the documentary.
But they knew each other before. They're both playwrights.
Yeah, there's a whole,
that whole
playwriting
world of the
community.
Yeah, yeah.
I've heard a lot of them. They're great with voice.
You would hope.
Yes, you would hope. And they watched a documentary about GLOW fell in love. And fell in love with the women, fell in love with the world, fell in love with the time period. And their enthusiasm. I'd been hoping Carly would do a show for a long time, and her level of enthusiasm with this. And they wrote a script, and I didn't love it. And I gave my thoughts, and they had their thoughts, and they didn't necessarily take mine, but the next script they did of it, it was like it all came together.
What was the thing?
Honestly, I don't remember the specifics of it.
But you like the world. You like the idea.
I love the world, and I felt like that very first draft, I wasn't sure. And then they kept coming back. They're like, no, this is, and we have a vision, this is it, and they showed me. And after that, it was like, I'm on board, I'm here.
Yeah. And that was that.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a weird, like, watching it. I only watched the first five. I don't know why I didn't get to see the other ones. But
because they weren't kidnapped.
Available. Yeah, yeah, right. But, I have to deal with watching me as an actor and then watching the show. But it does kind of, it's the show within the show, the wrestling, and that journey for the women in that, and then the drama behind it. There's a balance there, because, like, from doing the other two shows you've done, that, shit can get pretty dark.
Sure.
And there's no reason, like, some of this stuff in GLOW shouldn't be like, holy shit, menacingly dark. But the bigger agenda of the teamwork and the commitment to the craft of wrestling and becoming these other people, these superheroes, balances out in a very odd way. It's good, but like there was moments where I'm wondering, like, this should be more upsetting, but they're gonna wrestle,
right? Right. No, it's that balancing act always, because you have to have a dramatic spine,
right?
Always, and then you sprinkle in moments. And I'm a big fan of slamming comedy up against drama.
Well, you got to. And Allison's genius. Ugh. Everybody's so good.
Everyone's so good. And I'm actually impressed that you watch. I know so many actors who can't watch themselves.
I've learned to do it. Like, I've learned to do it with comedy because, I'm confident in that finally. Mm-hmm. Like, I can watch it objectively and
I was going to say, it takes a certain level of self-confidence and a certain level of liking yourself.
And accepting yourself.
Yeah.
And, like, over the years, like, I can watch comedy and go, like, that could have been better. This could have been better. I can make choices. I can watch myself do it and know where I'm at and not, feel horrible. But I used to.
Right.
But acting's different. Like, because, like, when you watch yourself acting, you're in it right then. You're like, oh, why didn't I? How come? Why did I just, you know, like, why'd they cut it there? You know,
I want to rewrite everything when I'm watching.
You do?
Oh, my God. And why didn't we get this? And the color's wrong. And, you know, I nitpick. When we start every season, we do a marathon of the last season.
You do.
So we go at the writer's room 7:30 in the morning and we leave after dark and we watch the entire season in one go with breaks for lunch and dinner and breakfast, lunch and dinner and beer. And it's amazing because it's the experience I think some people are having of just being washed in it. And it really gets you prepped to say, okay, we see where we ended. Where are we going to go?
Get back in it. Yeah.
But I start watching and it's just like, oh, what was, and you can't fix anything. It was very frustrating.
But the weird thing about that kind of stuff is like what I've learned from doing this show or from doing the podcast is that, you know, if you after it's all done and you having those thoughts, you all you can do is keep it to yourself because you're going to deprive someone else of experience. You know, like whatever you decided on is what it is. Like, right. I've had people on here that I didn't think the conversation went well, and I do the intros after. And after one time saying like, well, I didn't think it went that well, you know, people, they got mad at me for saying that, number one.
Right.
It diminished their ability to take in, take the conversation in a non-judgmental way. And a lot of times I'm completely wrong because how anyone else responds to something's got nothing
it's
to do
totally
with your
individual.
Dumb
also,
insecurities.
People don't know what's not there.
Right.
And you could be in love with a line that you cut and it's...
They don't know.
They don't know.
And you don't want to give it to them. That's why I used to have a real problem with releasing, the songs that didn't make it or outtakes or whatever. They're fun, but it's like, you know, the decision's been made.
Well, it becomes its own animal. I think it's yours until it leaves the printer and then it really becomes everybody's baby.
Yeah, definitely.
It takes a village.
So it does. So, like, you got this whole, like, I haven't been down to, I only went to the one read-through.
Mm-hmm.
I'm so surprised I wasn't more terrified and nervous.
No, everyone was, you were a cool customer.
Because, like, it's so weird. I didn't expect it to happen. Like, there's part of me that, like, you know, I had all these ideas of doing all these things when I was younger as a comic. I didn't do a show. And then somehow or another, like, everything worked out at a certain level in this day and age where, you know, I didn't have the pressure of being a mega star and I had a certain amount of freedom.
You can still go get a cup of coffee.
Right. But, you know, I did everything I wanted to do. And, like, one of the things I hadn't done was act, you know, in any real way in a series. And it was like it was a fluke. So there was part of me was sort of like, okay, yeah, I'll put myself on tape. But, like, it was a relief that, like, it's not on me. You know, I just got to do my job the best I can do it. And then, you know,
You were saying, it was interesting, you were saying that when on the pilot, I remember, well, the first episode, I remember you coming back to check the screen and you were still sort of in producer
Marin,
head, like
yeah,
you
yeah.
had to do everything.
Yeah.
And I may be speaking for you, but it seemed liberating for you when you finally were like, all I have to do is act in my scenes. This is it. I'm going to relax now. It's lovely. But I remember you feeling like you should have been checking takes.
It was weird because, like, you know, that's what you do when you're on a show. And I was in the show that I was on, so I was always running back. Did we get it? Was it enough? But that, I think that because of that, it did develop a communication with the writers.
And I
didn't have major fights with them.
Mm-mm.
And I was very, they weren't real fights. They were suggestions. And it was good.
At a certain point, the actors really know their characters. You knew your character. And the writers need to listen because that person's inhabiting this role. And the actor's instincts about it have to be honored.
Yeah. Yeah, there wasn't that many, you know, and they were great. You know, they were all great. I enjoyed working with them. And there was, but your office, that whole place back there.
Yeah.
Did you buy that building?
I did.
What was it? It was the Rita Hayworth?
Rita Hayworth's dad.
Yeah.
It was his building and there were dance studios upstairs.
Yeah.
And at the time there was a tiki restaurant and a theater for the productions and...
what kind of shape?
It took 2 years to renovate.
Really?
Yeah.
And it's in like, you shoot stuff there?
No.
You don't?
We don't. Although we're renovating the theater now. So that'll
As
be
a screening facility?
Or live theater. There's a guy from the Improv who's interested in starting his own thing.
And
we're talking to.
So you're going to like make it available to kind of lease-ish?
Yeah. Although... I knew it because when I was a kid, it was the Vagabond Theater, and I used to go there and watch old double features. And So part of me really wants to put in the infrastructure for screenings also.
You want to open a revival house?
But I mean, it's not going to...
Not like Quentin Tarantino, not a grindhouse revival house, but like classic double features.
Right.
Yeah.
I don't know what I'm going to do, but there's part of me that's like, I should honor this space and put the movies back.
So you're still doing press?
I don't do that much press.
Yeah.
I hate it.
Yeah.
And... everyone wants to see the actors anyway, you know. It's fine.
That's the other beautiful thing about doing this, about doing press for this. Like, I went out with we did a junket in New York, me and Betty and Allison, and I'm like, talk, it's your show,
right it's great.
It's just like, I watched some footage because you just sit there with a lot of different outlets, and like, I watched two of them, and it's just me looking at Allison talking.
But she has a lot to say. It's terrific.
It was great.
But you got to get in there. You have a lot to say, Allison.
No, I do, but I have to fight the urge, because, like, you know, coming from what I come from, it's been years of like, just pick your moments and shut the fuck up if you can.
Right.
You know what I mean? Because, like, as a comic guy, you're just sort of like, I'm going to, and then you're like, oh, no, it's just hanging back a
That's
minute.
That's discipline.
But, like, now with this show, it seems to me that, you only got to really know maybe five of us or four of us in the first season. And there's, like, so many. Like, it could go on forever.
Yep.
And we don't even know what any of those characters can do. That's or where the they idea. Can go.
Yeah. You want to start this engine that can run for a long time.
Was casting like amazing for Glow? I mean,
it was amazing. First of all, I think Jen Houston is great at her job. And
she is. She does all the stuff. I've known her since she was a kid.
And she loves unusual people. Mm-hmm. You don't get the same faces. She advocates. She's, and then there's so much talent out there. Yeah. If you give people a chance. But it was hard in that, you know, you're going to have to go into training. Yeah. It's going to be super physical.
It's so great to watch them all do it.
It's a show about bodies in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
And I tend to think, having done so many pilots and having fought really hard for it, I've really learned that when the process is relatively easy, you go with it's meant to be.
Uh-huh.
If you are pushing a rock uphill, I don't know. I think the universe conspires to make
what more should be difficult. Yeah.
And you've got to listen to that.
Yeah.
And I know people who are like, oh, it's too easy. This is not good. I don't trust it. But I think that's when it's great. It's because it's supposed to be in the world. I know that sounds, that's very back to Miss Charlotte and woo-woo.
If there's an ease to it, I guess people don't trust it because they think it could always, like, it's that compulsion that you seem to manage is that, you know, if you have that drive that's founded in being hard on yourself, you're always going to think it can be better or different or like,
well, that's true.
Right, but like that can pollute, you know, if you don't delegate.
Yeah, you have to delegate, right?
Yeah.
And at a certain point, you'd have to let go. You have to put your baby out.
I forgot the story I wanted to tell you. I don't know if you know it. Was, you know, because Carly and Liz are, they're kind of nerdy.
The best, yeah.
You know, and I'm like an old monster on some level. And I remember I made a couple of decisions about the character right at the beginning, like the glasses,
mm-hmm.
and that the way he did coke was going to be out of a bindle.
Right.
With a key or with a pen.
I remember you being very specific about that.
But when I told them that, I said, he's not flashy. He's a mm-hmm. user. You know, it's all practical. And I just went off on this rant and they're both looking at me. And I think it was Carly just goes, we're so glad you're here.
Yeah. Yeah. They were always good girls.
Exactly. It's just, I saw it in their face.
You gave them a little dirt in their sandwich. I think it's good. It's important.
Good. Good. Well, it was great talking to you. How do you
Lovely
feel about
talking
it?
Talking to you too.
Feel good, right?
I want to be write the whole thing.
You
but
do?
I'm good.
Like which parts?
No, I'm fine.
All right.
Fine.
Thanks, Genji.
Thanks, Mark.
What a smart, nice, decent person Genji is. I was happy to talk to her. Go to WTFpod.com for all your WTF pod needs. There's a new poster up there from my buddy Chris up in... Where was that? It was at, the Portland poster, right? Yeah, the Portland poster is up. I like it. It's up there at WTFpod.com in the merch area or whatever it's called. And get on the mailing list. I will email some stuff. Today, usually, it comes out. I email every week. I write you all a very nice letter. I can play some guitar. Why not? Why the fuck not? La 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 la
Boomer lives!
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.